Latino Stories, Historias Latinas, es un podcast que nace del proyecto de narrativas orales de latinos en Ohio, Oral Narratives of Latinos in Ohio, con entrevistas en español, inglés, and Spanglish.
Welcome to Latino Stories. I'm Elena Fowles. My guest today is Lillian Gorman. Lillian Gorman is a proud Chicana with deep roots in New Mexico. She is currently the director of the Spanish as Heritage Language Program at the University of Arizona and an assistant professor in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese. She served as a University of Arizona HSI fellow and as a scholar in residence at the Center for Regional Studies at the University of New Mexico in 2020, and is the recipient of the 2023 University of Arizona Mentoring Future Scholars Award from the Office of the Provost. Felicidades por todo esto, Lili.
Gracias.
Y bienvenida a este episodio. Lili, tell me about growing up in New Mexico. I love New Mexico, by the way.
I mean, it's all I really knew. My family's been in New Mexico for, since the 1600s on both sides. So it's definitely like where all the extended family is. So there wasn't a lot of, traveling outside of New Mexico for any reason. And I never, ever thought I would actually leave New Mexico. I thought I'd always be there because that's how my mom was and how my grandma, my grandmas were. And the only reason anybody left was for like military service or something. Both my grandpa fought in World War II and my other grandpa in the Korean War. But yeah, that was the only thing that seemed like the reason you would leave. Why else would you leave New Mexico? It was always like a feeling of this is where I belong. So I was born and raised in Albuquerque. My mom's from the South Valley of Albuquerque. And her parents, my maternal grandparents were from Belen. Well, actually my grandpa was from Pueblitos, which is a tiny little town outside of Belen. And Belen is a small town in and of itself, but, they met in Belen and after my grandpa got back from World War II and then, moved to Albuquerque, to the South Valley, which is a more rural area of Albuquerque. And, where there are there's a lot of people from Valencia County, from Belen, from Los Lunas who moved there and from, the East Mountain area. So that's just where they built their home. And that's where, I spent a lot of my childhood. It was between the west side of Albuquerque and the South Valley. Cause my sister and I have a twin sister. We were always at my grandma's house pretty much every day. So we were very much situated, as part of, my grandma and grandpa's house. I call them Nani and Papa. My Nani and Papa's house were that was home too. So that was a daily thing to always be with my grandma. And, but my dad's side is from Northern New Mexico. So, my dad's from born and raised in Santa Fe. So, we would spend a lot of time with my grandparents up there. My grandma, my dad's mom is from Taos, but she moved to Santa Fe when she was before she was even 20 and got a job with the state and stayed and met my grandpa, and the rest was history. She never wanted to go back to Taos, but that kind of strong connection of always being with grandparents and hearing the stories of how people got to where they are, but it was all just from one town to the other in New Mexico between, Albuquerque, Santa Fe, Taos, Belen.
Great. Was Spanish always present in your life and in the life of your family?
Yeah, it was always present. I mean, it was the first language or my grandma, my dad's mom, my Montoya side, her grandpa was Anglo. So there was a bilingualism there, but he always insisted everybody speaking Spanish so that her grandma would understand everything. Mm-hmm. So it was always there. It was always present. My grandparents on both sides were the generation that first kind of had to be the bilingual generation as far as needing to speak English in school to succeed and also experiencing a lot of, punishment in school for that reason. I know my grandpa Gorman from Santa Fe was put in special ed classes because he didn't speak English. And we have this letter from my grandpa's brother who was in World War II writing to him, telling him, you got to lose your accent because there's no way you're going to have success with that accent. You need to stop speaking Spanish, because I guess my grandpa wanted to already stop going to school and join the military like he had to. Mm-hmm. And he was telling him, no, you got to keep on and you got to speak English. So there was very much that environment around the importance of English, especially to not suffer in the ways that my grandparents did. So that was the attitude definitely passed on to my mom for sure. That's my Sanchez Aragon side. And then on Northern New Mexico, even though there was that attitude, yes, English is important, it was never about Spanish not being important. It was just, mm-hmm. you know, that's what you needed to speak to talk to, you know, all my great grandmas only, or one of my great grandmas only, I ever only heard her speak Spanish. So it's always there, but not necessarily something that young people felt was theirs. If I can say that, mm-hmm. like, it felt more like it was what we speak to our older relatives or what's spoken so that we don't understand, or maybe what we speak to each other when we're kind of messing around, but it's definitely like translanguaging and English and Spanish, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. there was a little bit of a distance in feeling like my Spanish isn't, it's not necessarily my language, or if it is, it's not right. I'm not speaking it the way I would hear it if a first generation Mexicano immigrant was speaking to me. And there was always like a sense of insecurity. But what I loved growing up hearing was the translanguaging of my grandparents, because it was so seamless and it was so just its own thing. Even my dad comments when I was doing my graduate work, my PhD in Chicago, and we would hear a lot of translanguaging in Spanglish, he would get a little thrown and he'd say, "This doesn't sound like what we do in New Mexico." And I'm like, "Yeah, it doesn't." Like, I like them both, but there's definitely differences there. And so my grandparents were masters at that. I just used to love to hear them speaking with their siblings when I was mm-hmm. little, and just mm-hmm. the way that they would go back and forth. And then as I got older and was already like very interested in language, I would even like record them on the phone talking to their friends, because there's something about that generation and the way that they would flow between the languages, to me, that was just like the most comfortable thing to hear. Mm-hmm. It's something that mm-hmm. my parents can't necessarily reproduce, and it's just like a soundscape of our viejitos that once they're gone, we don't have that anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting that you say, and it's true, right? Like translanguaging practices are common among bilingual or multilingual people, but also how it is so tied to region, to mm-hmm. families, right? And it will sound different how it sounds there in New Mexico, how it sounds here in South Texas.
Exactly.
In Ohio where I was, or in the Midwest where you were too. And that speaks also to just the diversity that there is, right, within the Latino community, right? And why it is so worth it, in my view, to study the Spanish, the U.S. Spanish, right? Because it is so unique. It is so diverse, so rich, right? In mm-hmm. history. And something that you said just now, what other type of Spanish study, you know, studying Spanish would make you feel like home, but that one, you know, that the one that's being spoken in your environment and the local environment. So when you said that, like, it sounds different, or like the image that came to mind was this feeling of like being home, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And it was funny because when I was started teaching Spanish as a heritage language classes in Chicago, I was very nervous before my first day teaching, because I kept thinking, these are second generation, generally Mexican or Puerto Rican individuals who still hear Spanish much more regularly than I grew up hearing it, or even that my mm-hmm. parents grew up, you know, that they feel comfortable perhaps speaking some to their parents and grandparents more regularly. So what are they going to even like have in common? Like, are they going to think, who is this person? But no, it was wonderful. What united us was our linguistic insecurities and the ways that we can map that out. But I was doing kind of some lessons on or class sessions on Spanglish, and I played them, or no, I don't think I played them. I showed them a newspaper column that we have that comes out in the Taos News and the Santa Fe New Mexican newspapers, written by Larry Torres, who is a master at Spanglish. And he does this newspaper column that's usually with these grandparents talking to their grandson, and it's very Spanglish, but mm-hmm. it's New Mexican Spanglish, Northern New Mexican Spanglish in particular. And when the students in Chicago read it, they were like, "What is this? Like, this doesn't sound real. This doesn't sound any way that anybody would really talk." So it was like the opposite, like them hearing something that sounded very jarring and really kind of reiterated the fact that there are different regional and generational mm-hmm. Spanglishes that you have to like be aware of. It's not all right. just it's not all the same. And it definitely, some sound more like home than others. And, you know, it's funny because everybody, especially people of my grandparents' generation or my dad, love that column because it sounds so real, but to my Chicago students, it sounded so artificial to them.
Great. Lily, when did you and why did you decide to study Southwest Hispanic studies? And how did they become so important to you? I imagine because, you know, of the place that you grew up, but I'm sure there's more to that.
Yeah. Well, I feel like going to the University of New Mexico, my sister and I were really proud to go to the University of New Mexico because that's where my parents went. That's where my grandparents went. And it was just where my grandpa went. So it felt like we were continuing a family legacy. But beyond that, it was something that I didn't realize was so rare. But the Spanish department at the University of New Mexico was very much about representing Northern New Mexico Chicano culture, which you don't always get that in Spanish departments. So it felt like a home, right? That where the things that I knew my grandparents grew up doing or saying, or even the fact that Sabino Ulibarri was still a professor there and I had him as a professor when I was an undergrad, like having that legacy of and presence of our Northern New Mexican culture being in the Spanish department was something that just made me feel like I want to do more of this. And I feel recognized here. I feel like I'm seen here. I feel like I have a place here. I'm around so many other, the majority of the other students are also, you know, of my same background, heritage learners. So having that, that kind of environment created this energy. Like I want to keep on with this. And I want to, I didn't actually take heritage classes as an undergrad because I'd AP'd out of them, but my dad took them in the '70s. And so I knew of them. And I just, the idea of being able to be in a program that promoted our place and our cultural belonging along with recovering Spanish, to me, like there was no better environment or no better idea of what to do. I didn't quite know what I would do with that afterwards because I, even though I was like the first generation of McNair scholars at UNM, and you know, the idea was that you wanted to go on to get a PhD, I couldn't see that. Like it didn't feel like something I could attain, or I could never imagine writing a dissertation when I had such issues writing, you know, not with my writing, but just actually getting it done. Like, cause when I wrote, I felt confident once it was done and I felt like I'd created something that was well-written, but it was really hard to just get the work done. Right. So I felt like I can't do a PhD. But so point is that like, I just wanted to do it because I loved that. I loved the opportunity to be able to explore more place and Chicano Latino culture, literature, and Spanish. And UNM had this unique, which I didn't know was unique at the time, option in the Spanish department that was very interdisciplinary, and that you were able to look at what I know now is Latino Chicano cultural studies and sociolinguistics together in a way that was always contextualized by Latinos. And to me, that is what a Chicano Latino studies scholar does, right? It's not about I'm defined by this discipline. It's that I'm defined by wanting to study realities of Latino communities through different disciplinary lenses. So that's what that program was and what it allowed me to do. And I loved that because it didn't feel right when I would take classes, which you have to as a master's student, you have to take classes in different disciplines within the department. And when I just take a literature class that wasn't connected to place or connected to Latinos, I was like, well, this is okay, but it doesn't feel like it's got the energy that I feel with the other program. So just having that possibility of the program, I didn't realize was so unique until I moved on to another Spanish department in my PhD. But that's just kind of the continued opportunity to be able to connect with where I was from and be able to do something that I think I was doing very much motivated by my dad and my grandparents, to be able to understand who they were in the language that they felt most at home at. And even though they were completely fluent in English, my dad was always very clear that we needed to know how to speak and we needed to speak, you know, pronounce things right. And just always in making sure that we were grounded in our Chicano culture from New Mexico. So it just felt like a way to really embody that and to make my grandparents proud, really. Cause my sister and I kind of realized if we don't take care of this, nobody else in our family is going to like be the caretakers of the language in this way, because like we were the oldest, pretty much the oldest grandkids. And so if we didn't start like set that new tone for this generation, it was going to be lost. And we already knew that it was something that was different in the way that our grandparents and our friends' grandparents felt with the language from other places, like the history of language in New Mexico. We knew that was different than like our friends who had, you know, Mexican grandparents and from Mexico, that there was something that needed to be, I don't want to say preserved, because I feel like there's always this discourse around we're losing our culture in New Mexico and we're losing this and we're losing that. I think it's changing and transforming in very interesting ways, but we still need to be caretakers of the past to understand the present and to mm-hmm. kind of to transform what we can, like a new, to create a new vision for what we can be in the future that invokes the past, but not by, you know, being aferrados to right, some type right. of myth or idea of what we were, what our language was. So all of that is why that program really spoke to me and why I was really excited to be a part of it. But I had no idea what I was going to do afterwards with that. Right.
So tell me a little bit more about your journey through higher ed as a Latina Chicana student. I mean, you started at a institution that was very welcoming to who you were and your background. Do you feel that you received a lot of mentoring support through, you know, undergrad and then when you moved on to do your graduate work?
I actually feel like UNM was not the easiest place because it was a large institution, right? Between 25,000-30,000 students. And it was those huge classes at first. And you knew that you, like my, I feel like I knew I belonged there because my family had been there and it was in my city and it wasn't like in some new place, mm-hmm. but it was definitely like potentially a very feeling of being anonymous and not really having like that you feeling like you were known or felt like you had a place there as far as like a home within the institution. It was through the Spanish department that I started to feel that. And mostly because of my professor, Enrique La Madrid, who was all about classes that were very Northern New Mexican based, which was different than at the time, the Centro, it's called El Centro de la Raza, which was like the Latino Student Center. But I almost felt like back then they were very much about a certain type of Latino, and that if you didn't identify with an overtly explicit Mexican national background mm-hmm. Or myths of Mexican Aztec ancestry of some sort, that you somehow weren't part of that community or you just didn't mm-hmm. feel welcome there. So the Spanish department was kind of like by default the place where I felt like you could be New Mexico Chicano in a way that we all were together recovering and maintaining our Spanish, like in a lucha compartida between all right. of us of what, where we were coming from and what we were doing. So I feel like through the Spanish department, through Enrique La Madrid and a program that he and the honors program professor used to run called Conexiones, or it's still run, but it was to take Chicanos. Basically, it wasn't overtly like only for Chicanos, but it tended to be all Chicanos to Mexico, to Morelia, Michoacan, and kind of go through this process together. Of what it means to be called gringo for the first time and be totally like shocked that you were being called that because that's not who you are. And so having that space was definitely created through Enrique in particular, through the Spanish department. Liana Rabolledo was also there at the time. And she was, you know, and the director of the heritage program, Maria Dolores Gonzalez at the time, like it was a very Chicano feeling in that Spanish department that was the home. And then McNair was also the other place that made me feel like, okay, I have this community. I think I can see myself as being some type of scholar, but I don't know what that really looks like. But the McNair program started in the year 2000 at UNM. And that's when I entered it as a first, the first class of McNair scholars. And I can't say enough about the McNair program and just how that set the trajectory and had me even begin thinking about a PhD. Like it never would have come to mind without that program and the mentorship. And it was a lot of local Chicanos that were in charge of that. Tim Gutierrez at the time, who was like, I think he became a VP of student affairs or something at one point. And so many others who were part of that and creating this community at UNM. So McNair was huge. And the Hispanic Association of Colleges and Universities, HACU, was also another community that through McNair that I was able to get connected to and start my internships. And I had a whole another career for 2 years full-time and another 2 years part-time working for the USDA Hispanic Serving Institutions National Program Office, that I was like all into education policy and Latinos in education in DC. And all of that was through McNair and that mentorship. So McNair and the Spanish department showed me about starting to kind of just pick people's brains and talk to people about their journeys and their paths. And how can you start creating a network of people that you can go to when you need advice or when you just want to talk things out. And that, that I think all of that happened before I started my master's. And then through my master's, I learned those skills even more. Definitely always having certain Chicano Latina professors who were the ones who I knew I could go to even to this day. I know that those key people from early on, I can still go to Enrique. I can still go to Jesse Aleman, who from the English department, who was amazing 19th century Chicano literature scholar. Like all these things kind of, all these people and all these networks created this mosaic of mentorship for me. So that's definitely, and then, sorry, go ahead.
No, when you transitioned to Chicago, where, which was a different, you know, type of university, a different environment, do you feel like you had, even if you didn't have the same, maybe number of potential Latino mentors at that institution, did you feel like you had the skills too to seek them out, like to really, to create a community when it wasn't just naturally there, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I did seek out like structures like McNair, and I think UIC had just lost their McNair program or something at the point. So I was, they weren't very well structured for supporting minority grad students. And at the time I was there, and I don't know that they are now either, but they didn't have a lot of those structures in place, but I had people, right? I knew like from Haku, when my first Chicago friend, Julio, who was there, who had worked at Haku and then was from Chicago, and I knew I could count on him. So there were like these people that were already kind of in place for me. And then my main mentor, Frances Aparicio, who is the reason I went to UIC, like she is the model of mentorship, in that she was like, I will take care of you, Lillian. And she did. And she has to this day, as far as still being a mentor and a friend, and but definitely having that kind of motherly, I mean, I'm not saying you have to have a motherly kind of mentor, but she took care of you and cared, like, and was going to be there to help you navigate things. And she always was. I mean, whether it be having cafecitos, or she even took me and my dad out to dinner when we first like got to Chicago. And it just felt, it also was really meaningful to have somebody who understood, like, she's Puerto Rican, right? But she understood Chicanos from the Southwest. She understood New Mexico, not just because Latino studies is her field, but she had that sensibility to understand different Latinidades and to put them in conversation with each other. So I felt right away this very, this closeness with her, and kind of just a way that I gave me confidence to be able to build networks, both at UIC and throughout Chicago. It was really helpful that that first fall that I was there, the Haku conference was being hosted in Chicago in 2007. So I remember I was able to just like have this feeling of being home with all these people that I knew. And so it felt like, okay, I have these people in place that I can go to, and I have enough confidence in kind of being able to navigate these spaces. I also took 2 years off, three years off from my master's to PhD. And two of those years I was directing the Spanish as a Heritage Language program at New Mexico Highlands University. So I also felt like I had a level of comfort in a new institution and in a department that wasn't where I went, because I'd already done that. Even though it was in New Mexico, I kind of knew how things worked, and I didn't necessarily have to feel like this lost grad student in those ways. And I was a little older too. I wasn't, you know, 22-year-old PhD student either.
Right. That's great. Lillian, tell me about your own role as a mentor now.
Well, so I just got this award that was really amazing through the Office of the Provost. It's funny, because when you are always seeking out mentorship, sometimes you don't realize how you're duplicating that wonderful mentorship you've had. So I feel like I've used all those models that have been so impactful to me as a way to kind of always connect with the students. And I think the main point is always just being human with the students and making sure that they know first and foremost that you care about them first as a person. And then from there you can build onto their work, because I feel like there's this pressure, and obviously I'm very committed to mentoring Latina and Latino grad students and undergrads, but all students, like just that they know that you care about them as a person first, mm-hmm. really sounds really like no brainer, but it goes a long way to just have those kind of relationships that you build just through being people first and not necessarily always talking about work and letting them see you as human, which sometimes is really scary because as a assistant professor, female Latina, you're often, as you know, like in student evaluations rated lower mm-hmm, just because mm-hmm. of those things. So if you show any vulnerabilities or humanness, it almost feels like you're opening yourself up to more. But if you don't do that, then how do you remain yourself? And how do you remain kind of the person that, how do I remain like my grandparents' granddaughter that I, that's like my favorite identity is to be that human, that person. So, I feel like just showing that side and making sure that the students know they can come to you and that you mm-hmm. can be that, that home, I guess, where they mm-hmm. can come and be themselves and show that insecurity if they need to, and then we can work through it together. So I feel like more than anything, it's just encouraging that kind of be yourself, but let's talk and let's map things out together that they don't have to do this by themselves.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Really yeah. Question. Oh yeah. No, that's great. Yeah, no, I mean, we, you know, throughout our lives and you get, good men, you know, you just have so many examples of good mentorship and not so good mentorship. And I always think, well, we always learn from everything. And so what we learn is that, you don't want to make people feel the way that you felt, you know, if somebody didn't care for you or only saw you for what you could produce, right? Instead of who you were. Because we are not, we're not removed, you know, from that. It's not two different things. We're the same person who is a person and who can produce things.
That is actually really important to the negative, perhaps, mentorship that you've received. I feel like that also has fueled me to do like the exact opposite of those type of experiences. Cause I haven't always had the positive mentorship. There's been some mm-hmm. negative experiences as well. And knowing that I will never put my grad student in this position, or I would rather do more work than put more work on them. That's mm-hmm. not equitable. That doesn't make sense as a grad student to put that on them, you know, that type of thing. So I feel like I'm extra sensitive to making sure that their workloads are what makes sense for a grad student and, mm-hmm. and that they feel, I mean, you're always going to feel overwhelmed as a graduate student or as an undergraduate student, but that I'm not somehow adding to that because of my own agenda of things I need to get done, or, you know, I don't see them mm-hmm. that way. It's not about seeing students as a commodity or an asset that can help you advance in any mm-hmm. way. It's not about that mm-hmm. at all. Like, I'm responsible for me getting my stuff done, not a grad student helping me with that in that way. So, I mean, unless it's going to benefit them in some way. So I feel like I'm creating that space for them to develop their interests and support them so that they can kind of feel confident in their own scholarly identity is really important mm-hmm. as well, even as undergrads. Yeah. And I just attended the dissertation defense of a student that I mentored as an undergrad who ended up going to Stanford and doing her PhD with Jonathan Rosa, and she just defended it and it was amazing. And I just felt like I am so honored to have played one small part in her undergraduate career to then see what she's done as a PhD student. So I just sit there in awe thinking, I've just done a little bit and they're the ones doing all this amazing work now. And just, it sounds kind of cliche to say, well, they're like, you train people to be better than you are, but I feel like that's the truth. Like you give them the small bit that you can, but they're going to be so much better because they feel hopefully supported to, and they don't feel the obstacles and they can
supported and empowered. I think sometimes, empowered, right? Because I mean, I've had experiences with a lot of undergraduate students that sometimes you just kind of plant that seed or open up that door or say, hey, look in here. And they just take, you know, that route and they really flourish. And also just the way that we continue to encourage our students. I have a couple, it's funny because I have this relationship with this student who I was part of. I was an advisor for her student org. And so she was never my student, but she's always like we connected and I was, you know, that organization was very important to me. And so we, I had a very close relationship with the students and the organization. So she and I had been connected, you know, she graduated and it's been like everything that happens in her life, she like keeps me updated. Yeah. And we like, when we are in the same city, we make plans to see each other. And the other day she just sent me a text and she said, "I am so glad you're in my life," you know, and it was so sweet to hear that. And she got accepted to a PhD program. And so you don't always know, like, even though academically I wasn't there to guide her in that way, but she sees the things that I do and how I, my career is going, and she finds inspiration on that. So sometimes you don't, you know, it's not always, I mean, yes, the relationship that she and I have is very important, but also what they see, you know, you do. Yeah. And how you behave or towards others, the choices that you make for you, for your family, those things are also models for them, you know?
Yeah, that's very true. You're making me think of other instances of just undergrads that maybe I didn't have in class, or we had very just once, but just little things that, and then they stay in touch with you and you find out these amazing things.
Absolutely. That brings me joy.
No, it does. I have a student right now. She's the program manager, it's student program manager for the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute in DC. And she was my student here at U of A she took one of my border studies popular culture classes. And I still remember she did a final presentation on Becky G when Becky G wasn't even as big as she is now. It was way back in 2016. And she was like, she writes to me and says, "I'm just like so happy you allowed me to do that because it got me thinking about things and thinking about these possibilities." And she like credits a lot of that to her going on to her position she has now. And I'm like, wow, that's great. Like, now I never listened to Becky G without thinking of this student. Because she's the one who introduced me to her, actually. But it was just these little small seeds. You're right.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Lily, you have been involved in Spanish for Heritage Language pedagogy and research and have been the director of the Spanish as a Heritage Language Program at the University of Arizona for some years now. And you're over 20 years as an educator and organically as also Heritage Language Speaker, right? How do you see the field changing and being responsive to our students now?
I'm just so excited now by, there's just so many new spaces for Spanish as a Heritage Language. But I also feel like there's increased recognition of the spaces that have historically been there as well. And I kind of found that to be my mission here at University of Arizona, to kind of discover that here, because the founder of the classes of heritage classes at the high school level and the University of Arizona, Adalberto Guerrero, did this in the early 60s. And there's not a lot of like recognition for that. And in the same way that I know so many Chicanos did it in New Mexico early on too, I feel like there was almost a sense, definitely when I was in my PhD, or that it was something new and that it was something that only linguists did or could do. And that didn't set well with me because I knew that not to be true. Not that I knew the story about Alberto Guerrero because I hadn't been in the University of Arizona yet, but I knew from my experience in New Mexico that there were a lot of people doing this work who weren't linguists, who were perhaps in Chicano studies or literature, but they had the correct pedagogies. And there were also a lot of people who shouldn't have been doing it, right? There were the whole eradicationist approach never dies, right? Even now, right? Mm-hmm. It's always living in some places, but there were also critical pedagogies present early on that maybe weren't being called that before we have this discussion about critical language awareness that's happened so strongly now that I love. I think a lot of people were practicing those pedagogies as well. So I feel like there's a renewed understanding, I hope, that this isn't new and that this has been going on and that our people have been doing this. And there's so many now more Latina, Chicana, Latino, Chicano, Chicanx, Latinx, Spanish as a Heritage Language practitioners, educators, mm-hmm. program directors that, you know, even through the Spanish as a Heritage Language Directors Network that we're both part of, that I feel like we have so many more people who have that background. And it doesn't mean that it's new. There have always been those who come from that background who share the same background as the students doing this work. But now there's more of us and we can talk mm-hmm. about the history and we can talk about the connections the importance of Chicano Latino studies, ethnic studies in this field, and that it's always been there. And it's not just about linguistics, which it has that mm-hmm. connection, but I mm-hmm. feel like there was almost a sense that you had to have a certain profile mm-hmm. to do this work and needed Tell to look a certain it. Way. Right. And that, and it was odd for me because I felt that more during my PhD when I'd already done this work. I directed my own program. I created my own program. I never wanted to be a theoretical formal linguist or even, you know, just a linguist. I wanted to use sociolinguistics as a tool to look at language and identity among my communities, but not define myself in rigid disciplinary ways. So I feel like now that's being let go of. And I think I feel empowered by saying, hey, actually it hasn't always been this way. I'm not just discovering it now. I lived it before, but now mm-hmm. I can feel more empowered to say it and to live right. that truth, because it's not about those who are from outside of our communities who have a certain academic training then saying, oh, well, I'm going to do heritage now. Like it actually comes from a background and a respect for a legacy of a field that I think has been a little invisibilized as far as, because a lot of the people who were practicing it weren't PhDs or they weren't scholars. They were people who were just teaching in the universities or they were scholars. Like when you look at people like Guadalupe Valdez, she didn't start in linguistics. She didn't do linguistics, right? And she's like a madrina of heritage mm-hmm. language. Frances Aparicio mm-hmm. is also a madrina of heritage language, started the classes at Harvard in the early 80s, you know, like at the heritage classes there. So you have all these people who many times I think are forgotten. And when we remember them, we can empower ourselves to broaden the field and to connect and serve the students better. So I think in that way, there's more spaces, there's more a connection to our critical past mm-hmm. that we can recognize.
Yeah. I mean, you just mentioned something that is so real, right? Like, as I remember when I was entering the heritage language field, like understanding I created all these courses, you know, at Ohio State, and I'm not a linguist. And I had people that would challenge that, right? Like, yeah. Are you the correct person? And then you talk about all the, you know, the heritage language program started within ethnic and Chicano studies. Like that's mm-hmm. where it came. That's where it lived. And it's not that. And so when we think about the sense of newness, I think it has to do with research that has been doing more specifically, right? With heritage language learners and things like that. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't happening, right? And so what I see too, just to add to what you just said, is that we're going back, right, to including Latino studies, Chicano studies within heritage language programs, because right. they're not one or the other. Like how do we talk about language without talking about identity, history, you know, our communities? And so it's not, it's very interdisciplinary. And it really, to me, to teach courses in heritage language, I would feel tied, you know, or tied down if I couldn't teach it in a way that is very much focused in Latino studies, right? Or yeah. Chicano studies.
Mm-hmm. I don't know any other way. And so that's why it's odd. And I think that's why all of us, I think historically, we've all kind of made our own materials and things because textbooks have never understood this. Mm-hmm. And so they've mm-hmm. never felt organic or real or necessary, like necessarily anything that feels community-based. So yeah, I'm happy for this. I hope it's a turn. And I also feel like it's a lot of overlap with recognizing those who are doing the same type of work in education. Cause I think mm-hmm. there's
absolutely,
I've learned this from Alberto Guerrero who did so much advocacy that led to the Bilingual Education Act. Like in the 60s, you know, when the Young Lords and the Chicano movement were all doing this work around language, it wasn't separated between higher ed and K-12. It was all together. And mm-hmm. so for us to be artificially separated from our colleagues who are doing this work in K-12, it makes no sense. So this kind of divide between bilingual ed or heritage language, like we need to all be talking the same about.
Absolutely. You know, and supporting each other, because we need that, right? I know that We need that fluid communication between our K-12 educators and us in higher education, because we're serving the same population, right? And we want the same goal is also to empower our students, right? And to see themselves in the courses that they take and the language that they speak and so on. I appreciate you recognizing that and actually experience it, right? You experience it as a student. And so that's very powerful that, we can go back to maybe doing research or learning about, those waves, you know, from early on, but also to have this first person knowledge of those programs also very, very important, right? So Lily, you have a new book coming out titled Zones of Encuentro: Language and Identity in Northern New Mexico with the Ohio State University Press. So yes. Congratulations. Thank you. Exciting about that. So you haven't been busy at all. Like there's like you.
Not much.
Talk to us about this work. How is it? When did you start this? What is this book about?
Well, it's been definitely a long-term project. It was ethnographic work that I did in Northern New Mexico, centered around interactions between Northern New Mexican Nuevo Mexicanos and first generation Mexican immigrant populations. And it did stem from my dissertation research initially, and then kind of got reframed and additional kind of data collected for the book itself. But it really came from this feeling of Northern New Mexico always being either depicted as this place of old Spanish and old kind of this way of life that's disappearing, and it's all puro nuevo mexicano that, you know, identify as Hispano and Spanish and all this, and or people from the outside not understanding that there is a difference to being nuevo mexicano and thinking that everybody identifies with some type of Mexican national identity at some point. And so it was kind of a way of grappling with the diversity within the Northern New Mexico population, but also these spaces where there are encounters, you know, that I would see within my own family of particularly in church spaces and education spaces where mm-hmm. you see a clash between, well, these individuals from my Northern New Mexican family perspective, like we try and speak Spanish with them, but we always feel inadequate. And then there's this misunderstanding that's occurring when there's a sense that maybe a perception on the people they were interacting with from Mexico that we didn't have enough pride to continue speaking Spanish or something. So this like disconnects in understanding each other's histories. But the fact that we're all in Northern New Mexico means we're sharing this particular space that has often been characterized as only one way, as only belonging to one group, where this is not the case. I remember walking with my really good friend and colleague, Mariah, to the Santuario de Chimayo on Good Friday, which is a pilgrimage that a lot of people do in Northern New Mexico. And it just occurred to me, I was hearing a lot of Spanish, but not Northern New Mexican Spanish. I was hearing a lot of Mexican Spanish, and there were a lot of what seemed to me Mexicano individuals that weren't Northern New Mexican. And I was like, wow, this means something to others who aren't from this region. This is interesting to me. And it's like a total no-brainer. Of course it would. But I kept thinking, well, even me, I had thought of Northern New Mexico as being this place that the only people who weren't, you know, there was the native population, and then there's the Northern New Mexican Hispanic population, and then there's the Anglos who come in and change everything. But there wasn't any discussion about what happens when you have two Latino populations that are interacting and how do they influence each other and these spaces that are often viewed one way. Because I think historically, Nuevo Mexicanos have always been reacting to Anglo encroachment, and there hasn't been a discussion about what happens when you have a different type of interaction. And there is also this sense of, oh, Mexicanos are coming and changing the city, and it looks, you know, in our Catholic churches, the masses feel different, and there's these people, you know, all these kind of negative things happening. There was some news coverage in the mid 2000s around Northern New Mexico high schools. There being a lot of fights between Hispanic New Mexican students and more Mexican identified individuals. So there was a lot of hype around conflict. But I also had experience from teaching in Las Vegas, New Mexico, at New Mexico Highlands University, surprisingly, several students whose families were mixed. Their one parent was Mexican, first generation, immigrated to Northern New Mexico as a teenager. and married with a Northern New Mexican. And I thought, this is really interesting because these students had a different confidence in Spanish, even though they still used the lexicon from Northern New Mexico. They just had a different connection to confidence that I hadn't seen in a lot of my other Northern New Mexican students. Mm-hmm. So that got me thinking about, well, what ways can we look at language and identity through this lens, not just through the interactions in different spaces, but within a family. So that's what this book is about. It's about 10 Northern New Mexican families that have one parent who's a Mexican first-generation immigrant who came to Northern New Mexico as a teenager or older, and a Northern New Mexican parent who has roots in New Mexico since before it was Mexico. So they have, and that kind of allows us to rethink what is our heritage in Northern New Mexico? Because these aren't new interactions. Right. And how can we problematize, especially in these moments now where you have a lot of conflict around what is our heritage in Northern New Mexico? When you have the taking down of monuments to conquistadores, you have a lot of emotion around that and talking about, well, you're taking away our heritage. Well, no, let's actually talk about what our heritage is. Our heritage is so much more than feeling connected to a Spaniard, you know, conquistador, which I know is politically based in wanting to feel some type of identity separate from Anglos, but and to that type of colonization, but rethinking what our heritage was, what it is, what it could be, in looking at these particular interactions and diversifying the narratives around who lives in Northern New Mexico and how do we interact and what does this do with our Spanish? One of the, you know, there's a lot of stories in my book around conflict of being critiqued for speaking a certain way, of Northern New Mexicans being made fun of for the way they speak by Mexicanos or by their suegros who are, you know, why are you using that word? Or that sounds weird. But there's also stories of Mexicana, one in particular, who's an educator in Northern New Mexico, now being a fierce advocate for the preservation of Northern New Mexico ways of speaking and always defending. So you have these really beautiful spaces of understanding, of encuentro, where they are able to kind of have moments of solidarity, moments of conflict, all wrapped in one family, all wrapped in, you know, in one space. So that's what the book kind of looks at in a condensed description.
Great. I mean, it sounds wonderful. When does it come out?
October 11th. So I will, yeah, that's when the official publication date is, but it's in.
Great. I can't wait right to now. Share it, to read it, to share Thank it everywhere.
And yes, it's also very much about inserting in a scholarly way Latino Chicano studies with sociolinguistics, applied critical, critical applied linguistics, sociocultural linguistics, everything kind of in a way that you can only look at these spaces through this interdisciplinary lens. You can't do it one way or the other, else you're losing, you're losing the feel of what you're talking about.
Right. So Lilian, I see a lot of book talks coming your way in the near future. And so you'll be busy doing that as well. But what other plans do you have for this year, for 2024?
For 2024, my grandma, Virginia Gorman, Montoya de Gorman, she will be turning 94 in July. So yay. I always look forward to spending a lot of my summer with her, which is really important for me. So that's, I know that's not professional, but it is what sustains
absolutely.
And just actually because the book and my tenure process and everything was so all consuming in the last year or so, I really look forward to spending more time just with all my family in New Mexico. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just important. My sister's getting married in October and we're going to have a lot of family celebrations, but yeah, that's important to me. But I also have some research that I'm doing with, bilingual teachers that I'm looking forward to advance on. And also I belong to a group in Chicago. It's a quilting group with older Latina Mexicana ladies that do this really amazing story quilts. And I'm looking forward to kind of documenting that a little bit more and perhaps writing a piece on that. Maybe something not as academic where we're actually showing and, you know, pictures of the quilts and talking about them, but it's such an amazing space that I luckily have still been able to stay connected with since I've not been living full-time in Chicago.
Great. No, that we need those stories as well.
Yeah,
definitely. Especially, you know, places like that you wouldn't think are happening. Right. So that
yeah. Would be and great. That's actually, even through the pandemic, we were able to connect even more, right. Cause we were able to just be on Zoom and talk like that. And my grandma in Santa Fe that we're going to be celebrating her birthday. Her mom, my great grandma Lily, who I'm named after, she was a quilter, and we were able to connect the ladies in Chicago with my grandma through Zoom and talk about quilting. And so there's like zones of encuentro also through those type of intergenerational regional Latino spaces. So I'm excited to keep exploring those types of spaces.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing both professional and family plans. That's important, right? Because that makes us whole. So that's great. Lily, muchas gracias por esta conversación.
Gracias. Gracias al programa Latino Stories. I love it. I love the work that you're doing. And then professionally, I love the work you're doing. So thank you, Elena. It's been really nice to have this conversation with you.